Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Perform Care's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Provider Series. And my name is Stacey Rivenberg. I'm a psychologist advisor here at Perform Care. And just wanted to remind everyone that this session is being recorded, and that recording is placed on our website. So if you do not wish to have your image part of that recording, please stop your video at this time. The chat will be open throughout the duration of our presentations today. So please feel free to put your questions and comments in the chat. We have two speakers today. And after each speaker is done at the end of our session, we will have time for that Q&A. I will turn it over to Tony House now for introduction.
All righty, let me introduce today's speakers. First, Carmen McKinney, whose pronouns are she and her. Carmen is a queer identified therapist and a licensed clinical social worker with 15 years of experience in mental health. She currently serves as the behavioral health clinic supervisor at Alder Health Services in Harrisburg. She obtained an MSW from the University of Alabama, Roll Tide, and holds a postgraduate certificate in affirmative therapy with transgender communities from Widener University. She specializes in working with LGBTQ plus individuals and is passionate about improving outcomes and access to care for all marginalized and traditionally underserved populations. And then following Carmen this morning is Dr. Yavar Mujimi. Dr. Mujimi is the medical director of behavioral health for AmeriHealth Caritas District of Columbia and is responsible for improving behavioral health quality outcomes by enhancing the integration of behavioral health services with primary care and developing partnerships with community stakeholders to better reach enrollees with behavioral health and/or substance use needs. He previously was a psychiatrist at Whitman Walker Health, a community health center with a special expertise in LGBTQ and HIV care. People, please welcome first Carmen and then Dr. Mujimi.
Hi, good morning, everybody. As Tony said, and thanks for that introduction, Tony. My name is Carmen McKinney, and I am the behavioral health supervisor at Alder Health Services. Today, I'm going to be talking to you about LGBTQ plus identities. We are going to first talk about what all of those letters mean and go over some other relevant terms and information. So we will get started. So the first thing that we will talk about is sexual orientation, which is the L, the G, and the B in LGBTQ+. Sexual orientation is a description of who someone experiences attraction towards. So any person can fall on any range of this scale. So someone may be attracted only to men, only to women, fall somewhere in between, or experience attraction towards all genders or no genders. The L in LGBTQ plus refers to a female who experiences attraction to other females. The G is gay, which means the same as homosexual. So a person who experiences attraction towards people with a gender that's the same as their own. Bisexual traditionally means someone who experiences attraction towards males and females, but I did want to point out that it's also used to mean someone who experiences attraction to two genders, which may not necessarily be male and female. Heterosexual, or being straight, is also a sexual orientation. I'll point out too, sexual orientation can be fixed or fluid. For some people, their orientation is the same throughout their life. For a lot of other people, it might change over time. A couple of other terms with sexual orientation. So asexual or gray sexual. Asexual is someone who doesn't experience sexual attraction towards anyone. And gray sexual is a term that people use that identify primarily as asexual, but occasionally or sometimes experience attraction towards others. Pansexual, someone who experiences attraction towards people regardless of what their gender is, and regardless of sex assigned at birth. So someone that could be attracted to anyone regardless of their gender. Polysexual is someone who's attracted to more than one gender, but not necessarily all of them. Demisexual, someone who experiences attraction towards people only after forming an emotional bond with them. So they don't experience that physical attraction as far as with appearance, it's more emotional. Romantic orientation is another orientation term. It refers to emotional and romantic attraction, and it's not always the same as someone's sexual orientation. Often romantic orientation is indicated with the same prefixes used for sexual orientation. So aromantic, someone who doesn't experience romantic feelings towards other people. Heteroromantic, similar to heterosexual, but romantic. Demiromantic, biromantic, homoromantic, just follows the same patterns as for sexual orientation. Next thing we'll talk about is gender identity, which is the T in LGBTQ+. Gender identity is a person's internal sense of who they are as a person in regards to gender. Just like with the last slide, someone may identify completely as a man or as male, completely as a woman or female, or anywhere on the continuum in between, or something else altogether. A lot of times people see the acronym LGBTQ+ and they think not straight or not heterosexual, but that's not exactly correct because gender is completely separate from orientation. Gender binary is the idea that there are two distinct genders, male and female, and that everybody fits into one or the other category. And primarily this is based on the sex the person was assigned at birth. Cisgender is a term refers to someone whose gender identity is the same as the sex they were assigned at birth. So a person who was assigned female at birth and identifies as a woman is a cisgender woman. Transgender refers to people whose gender identity is different from the biological sex they were assigned at birth. So a person who was assigned male at birth but is a woman, identifies as a woman, would be referred to as a trans woman, a trans girl. Transgender is somewhat of an umbrella term because a lot of times it also refers to folks who are non-binary, which is our next word. And non-binary is the gender identity other than male or female, regardless of what their sex assigned at birth was. A couple of other terms that are good to know: agender, someone who identifies as something other than female, or doesn't identify with the gender at all. Gender queer is a term that could mean between genders, beyond binary genders, or a combination of genders. Pangender identifies as all genders. Bigender identifies as having two genders. Gender fluid, their identity moves between two or more genders. Two-spirit is a term used in some indigenous cultures that refers to people who are outside of the gender binary. So the Q and the plus in LGBTQ+ includes a couple of other populations. So queer is kind of an umbrella term for anyone who identifies as not heterosexual or not cisgender. It's used similarly to the acronym LGBTQ+. Questioning also can be the Q, which is someone who's questioning their gender identity or sexual orientation. Intersex is someone who is born with a combination of sex characteristics that's outside of what's typical for binary male or female bodies. This might mean something about their chromosomes, their internal or external sex characteristics. It's kind of impossible to give an exact number of how many people this is because there's no universally accepted definition of what exactly counts as intersex. But intersex people definitely exist, and a lot of them identify as part of the LGBTQ plus population. Sex assigned at birth is the determination of biological sex based on the external appearance of a person's genitals at birth. Sex assigned at birth is often noted or described as AFAB or AMAB, so assigned female at birth or assigned male at birth. Legal sex is the designation on a person's legal identification documents, so the birth certificate, driver's license, social security card. Some people who are transgender choose to have their legal sex changed to align with their gender. Some people don't. Gender expression refers to outward presentation of gender, so could be personal style, hairstyle, clothing, just presentation. Often gender expression is described as feminine, so things that are traditionally related to females, or masculine, which is traditionally related to males. Androgynous sometimes is a term that's used to mean both feminine and masculine. Gender nonconforming is someone whose gender expression is different from cultural norms expected of their gender. And we have the gender unicorn, which just sort of describes all of those things. So as we were saying, gender identity is what someone's gender, so can be female, male, something else, non-binary. Gender expression is more how they present, how they express their gender outwardly. Sex assigned at birth is biological, and then orientation is physically attracted to or emotionally attracted to. LGBTQ plus identities have historically been and continue to be pathologized and stigmatized. I put a couple of facts up here. Homosexuality was considered a mental disorder until 1973 and was not entirely removed from the DSM until 1987. So, you know, a lot of us, that was within our lifetimes, that being gay was considered a mental illness. So if you think about the effect that that may have on people, being told that who they are means that they're mentally ill. As related to transgender people and accessing medical care, historically there has been a lot of gatekeeping by the mental health system for people to be able to access medical care, gender transition related medical care. It has changed a lot over the years, but in the past there were a lot of hoops to jump through. People would have to see a therapist for years, basically prove that they were transgender enough to get healthcare, which, as you could imagine, would be pretty traumatizing. So again, it's different now, but just this history does make it difficult for LGBTQ plus identity people to trust the medical system and to trust the behavioral health system. Stigma still exists and discrimination is common. And I will even say, you know, when I'm looking at the statistics, a lot more common than I even would have thought. The survey was from 2013, but of LGBT people, 58% reported being the target of slurs or jokes. 39% reported being rejected by a family member or a close friend because of their orientation or gender. 30% had been threatened or physically attacked. 21% experienced discrimination at work. 29% had been made to feel unwelcome in a place of worship. And 30% of youth had missed at least one day of school in the last month because they felt unsafe or uncomfortable going to school. The 2015 U.S. Transgender Survey, which was the largest survey to date of trans people in the United States, 46% of respondents reported being verbally harassed because of their gender within the last year. 9% had been physically attacked within that year. So that's not lifetime, just within that year. 10% had been sexually assaulted within that year, and 47% reported being sexually assaulted at some point in their lifetime. That is a pretty significant number, I think. 30% reported discrimination in the workplace. 15% were unemployed compared to 5% of the general population. 33% of trans people reported at least one negative experience with a healthcare provider related to their gender identity. That's a pretty large group of people. Again, that goes back to the mistrust of medical providers, behavioral health providers. 23% reported not seeking healthcare that they needed due to fear of being mistreated. I know that we have talked about in previous sessions, we've talked about intersectionality. So of course the risk of experiencing discrimination and violence is higher for racial minorities, undocumented and disabled LGBTQ plus individuals. Mental health disparities. I just put a couple of things up here, both pretty significant. LGBTQ plus individuals are 2.5 times more likely to experience depression, anxiety, and substance use compared with straight cisgender people. Trans individuals are almost 4 times as likely as cisgender people to experience a mental health condition. A recent data analysis found that suicide risk for lesbian, gay, and bisexual adults to be 3 to 6 times higher than for heterosexual adults. And again, from the transgender survey, 40% of trans individuals reported having attempted suicide at some point in their lifetime, 40%. The general population, it is 4.6%. That is a huge, huge difference. The Trevor Project, their most recent survey reported that 45% of LGBTQ youth surveyed had seriously contemplated suicide within the last year, and 14% had attempted within that year. It is important to note too that LGBTQ youth who feel supported by their family report attempting suicide at half the rate of those who are not supported. So support is extremely, extremely important, literally life or death. So this stigma leads to discrimination, not only in healthcare, just in public, in general. Everywhere. Discrimination, of course, we know increases minority stress, and minority stress contributes to increased health disparities. So ways to avoid increasing minority stress. First of all, and when working with or talking to LGBTQ plus people, don't make assumptions about anything, basically. You can't assume gender or orientation based on what someone looks like. You can't assume sexual orientation based on someone's gender identity. You can't assume what somebody's anatomy is or what sex they were assigned at birth based on their gender. And you can't really, you can't assume relationship status based on orientation. Everyone is different. Just don't assume things. some common assumptions. Just think back and think if you have made any of these common assumptions. A woman presenting in a masculine style is a lesbian, or that person is a transgender man. A man and a woman who are married, who are a married couple, or a heterosexual married couple. Not necessarily true. Transgender women only date or have sex with men, and or transgender men only date and have sex with women. Definitely not true. As I mentioned, gender identity and sexual orientation are not the same thing. They're entirely separate. Someone can be cisgender or transgender and be gay or straight or bisexual or any of these other orientations that we talked about. People who are transgender want to pass as cisgender or don't want anyone to know they're trans. Some people do, and some people don't. Some people prefer, they present intentionally, you know, and prefer to be seen as trans rather than to be seen as a cis person. Though some people, you know, would prefer to be seen as cis and for people to not know that they're trans. People who are LGBTQ plus don't have to worry about birth control or unintended pregnancy. Definitely not a true assumption. There are plenty of people who fall into this category who, you know, do need to use birth control and could potentially become pregnant. Someone who is assigned male at birth and wears women's clothing is a transgender woman. Or is gay, they may or may not be. They may be neither of those things, or they might be both. So we've talked about microaggressions in previous sessions. So I just wanted to go over a couple of common microaggressions. Obviously, facial expressions that reveal disgust or confusion. Asking inappropriate questions. Specifically, I'm thinking about surgery, body parts, sexual relationships. You would not believe some of the things that people think it's okay to ask someone because they identify as transgender. Redirecting someone to a different bathroom. Repeatedly using incorrect pronouns or referring to someone by their dead name to the person directly or to other people. And I'll note, dead name is a term that people use referring to the name that they were given at birth if they go by a different name. Backhanded compliments about appearance or gender expression, such as, "Oh, you're so pretty, you look just like a real woman." Of course, that is a microaggression because it is implying that trans women are not real women. You look so different since you've been on hormones. I bet no one can even tell that you're transgender. Maybe meant as a compliment, but again, implying that being seen as transgender is negative. "Oh, he's so hot, I'd date him even though he's trans." Again, implying that being transgender is somehow less than being cisgender. Or, "You don't look non-binary when you dress like that." Implying that someone's not presenting their gender in a way that you understand, that works for you. Unsolicited advice about gender expression, makeup, hair, clothing, etc., are ways to pass, such as, "You'd look more like a woman if you wore your makeup like this," or, "You should try talking a deeper voice so you sound more like a man." Because I know we have a lot of mental health service providers on the call, I added this slide. I'm providing therapy services to LGBTQ plus individuals. Of course, many people in the LGBTQ plus community have been through some type of trauma in their life. So trauma-informed care is important. Sharing your own identity and pronouns is a good idea. It helps clients feel more comfortable sharing theirs. Keep in mind when you are, if you have a client, you're working with someone who is transgender or, you know, or gay or lesbian, that it's not always about gender or orientation. Transgender individuals seek out therapy for the same reasons everyone else does. Don't ask inappropriate personal questions of your clients that are unrelated to the reasons that they're seeking treatment. If someone is coming in for treatment for depression or anxiety, you know, don't ask these intrusive questions. Ask yourself before you ask, ask yourself if you would ask a cisgender or a straight client the same questions. And seek out information on your own, which you're all doing because you're here. Avoid having your client teach you about LGBTQ+ issues. We have talked some about privilege, and I think that cisgender privilege is something that we don't often think about, as, you know, with any other groups, the groups who are more privileged tend to not notice these things. So just think about for a minute how these experiences might be different for a transgender person or a non-binary person versus a cisgender person. Taking an international trip. If someone's appearance or gender expression doesn't match what's on their passport, or, you know, different countries may have different expectations about gender. Most people who are cisgender don't necessarily have to think about their gender if they are getting on an airplane or going to another country. Applying for a job, same thing with, you know, legal gender, legal name may be different. Obviously, fear of discrimination. Getting pulled over for speeding. Going to the doctor for a broken arm. People who are cisgender, if they were to go to the doctor for a broken arm, the doctor would probably not ask them about their gender, their sex assigned at birth, or anything along those lines. You would be surprised to hear how many times people who are trans identified go to the doctor for a cold or an injury, and for some reason, their gender comes up and they're faced with a bunch of questions about their gender or identity. Going to the doctor for reproductive health care. And I don't think I need to explain much about that. That's going to be a completely different experience for someone who's cisgender as opposed to someone who is transgender. Running into an acquaintance you haven't seen in several years, particularly for folks who have transitioned or present differently than they presented in the past, or attending a high school reunion, seeing people you maybe haven't seen in 20 years. And that is all I have for today. Here's a slide with my resources. And of course, I'll be available after the next presentation for questions. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Carmen. And next, we have Dr. Mujimi.
Hi, good morning, everyone. So I am Dr. Yavar Mujimi. I am a as Tony mentioned, our behavioral health medical director with Mayor Health Caritas DC. Really just gonna add to the the talk that was just given, and be a lot of overlap and just sort of reinforcing the same ideas that were just shared. You know, a lot of this stuff bears repeating so that we know how to best manage and work and provide gender affirming care for our consumers, our enrollees, our members when they come into our offices. So, you know, there's a lot of different images out there that have been used to kind of try to help explain the fluidity between gender identity, gender expression, sexual orientation, biological sex. And so this is, you know, another way that this information has been presented. Again, reinforcing what we were just talking about, that, you know, gender identity is how you in your head define your gender based on how much you align or don't align with what you understand to be the options for gender. And your expression are the ways that you present your gender through your actions, stress, and demeanor, how those presentations are interpreted based on gender norms. Biological sex is your physical sex characteristics that you're born with and develop, including genitalia, body shape, voice pitch, body hair, hormones, chromosomes, etc. And then we're for sexual attraction, you know, you can see the spectrum here of both asexual attraction to being attracted, sexually attracted to women, females, femininity, or being attracted to men, males, or masculinity, and a similar category here for romantic attraction. Just wanted to share, you know, at AmeriHealth and with that Perform Care is also a part of, this is an area that obviously in our broader programs to address health disparities, we recognize that we have to be addressing health equity issues as it relates to sexual orientation and gender identity minority communities, also known as LGBTQIA+. So as a part of that, we do keep data collection around those pieces of information, because you have to start from a place of knowing who are your members in your health plan, and figuring out what are the best services that are going to help them meet their health goals. And, you know, obviously it's for many individuals, Medicaid is a lifeline for sexual and gender identity minorities living in the U.S. Medicaid expansion played a huge role for individuals to be eligible for programs and access to gender affirming care in a way that wasn't accessible before. There's about 386,500 uninsured individuals that could now qualify for Medicaid in states that plan to expanded Medicaid. And obviously there are places in the country where that hasn't happened yet. So those disparities and access to care continue to exist. And there's an estimated 1.5 million LGBTQI plus adults for 65 and older as well. So there's another issue around aging population and how those needs will be addressed as well, especially as folks enter into Medicare. So for us, our domains of our health equity program, right now we're focusing obviously on the education and training piece, where we want to make sure our provider network is culturally responsive and understands best practices. But as I mentioned, there's other aspects that we're working with internally, how we can, with our own policies, how we're enhancing our culturally responsiveness with key community organizations, the data collection utilization I mentioned, our supporting our members by providing safe, culturally responsive allied services, connecting them to the right provider network based on their needs. And so this was we're obviously at a point now where gender affirming care and transgender health has become, we've reached the tipping point where, you know, this is no longer an area that is sort of in the shadows. This has come to our forefront of our healthcare and pop culture, and also unfortunately in the culture wars, and the both You can see both the increased access that is being delivered in some areas, while at the same time a backlash in other parts of the country where there has been more restrictions placed around it. And so I think it's important to talk about what actually is gender-affirming care, because a lot of people are throwing this term around very broadly now without necessarily explaining what it is. Gender-affirming care is physical, mental, and social care that affirms and supports the diversity of needs across gender identities. So you can see that there's nothing here specifically that talks about procedures, medications, because that's really up to the individual and what their desire is around their gender identity. So I think it's particularly when you see some of the legislation that's being written out there, it doesn't really go into this understanding of what gender-affirming care really means. And obviously, you know, the issues that were brought up before, one third of transgender folks report being refused medical care or harassed by medical professionals because they are transgender, and one fifth have been refused medical care because of their transgender or non-conforming status. So just because you have access to healthcare doesn't mean that you're getting gender affirming care. So, and the experience for folks being refused or harassed is obviously a deterrent to seeking healthcare. And it can create risks where healthcare is being received in a more black market sort of environment where there's not the same level of oversight that's being provided, and there's safety risk and issues there. So I did want to just highlight, you know, I talked about in our larger society and landscape, on the one hand, there's been a tremendous amount of legal protections that have been put in place. You can see a list here of some of them, with Medicare coverage for gender-affirming surgery. Many states have put bans in place for trans exclusions for both private insurance and Medicaid coverage. HHS had issued health insurance rule preventing insurance companies from categorically denying coverage of the surgeries. In the state where I work, there was specific protections put in place for gender-confirming surgery, and then even the issues around gender-neutral bathrooms has been also, certain states have put protections in place. And Biden had also signed an executive order around expanding protections for transgender students, repealing the ban on transgender members of the military. So while all of these legal protections are in place, of course, we are currently in an environment where, to be honest, I can't keep track of all of the different rules that are being placed in various states. You know, we saw initially there was a focus a lot on sort of bathroom bills, where there were states barring students from using sex-segregated school facilities that align with their gender identities. And more recently, we've been seeing specific bans on medical care in certain states. So you can imagine identifying as transgender or non-binary, and depending on where you're located, the access to care is not only limited, but also there may be certain states where it's actually specifically prohibited. We've also seen this push for transgender youth sports bans that have also been another type of legislation that's been actively targeting transgender individuals. And the reason I bring up this, all of these different, I think it's important to understand the environment that we're currently living and operating in, because if you identify as transgender or your ally and trying to support individuals, you know, there's a lot of fear that's currently out there, and a sense of safety, which you'll see as I go through the transgender health survey, that definitely impacts mental health, definitely impacts accessing healthcare services, and ultimately, you know, the outcomes that we're seeing. I think it's very important wherever you're practicing, because, you know, a lot of these services are considered special, you know, that, I mean, ideally as a part of these trainings, no matter where you're practicing, you have some level of comfort in working with this population. But there are very specialized locations like Alder Health Services that spoke earlier, and particularly in Pennsylvania more broadly, there's quite a few resources that should be taken advantage of. One of the biggest trans health conferences nationally actually happens annually in Philadelphia as a part of the education efforts of the Mazzoni Center, which is similar to where I had worked in DC, kind of a health center focused on LGBTQ health services. So again, just to go in, the transgender survey that came out, and there should be an updated version coming out soon as well, really highlighted the experience of transgender people in a way that was never quite fully highlighted in many domains. One of the areas that we're looking at was the experience of violence towards transgender people. And there was, unfortunately, a very high risk for hate violence, crimes. You could see majority of hate violence homicides were transgender women, with a disproportionate amount being African-American, 7 times more likely than cisgender people to experience physical violence at the hands of police. And then not just in society at large, but even in interpersonal violence in relationships was disproportionately affecting trans women of color. 1 in 4 transgender people had experienced a bias-driven assault. We talked earlier about just the importance of family support and the impacts of violence in the home. 10% of those who were out to their family reported their family was violent towards them. 8% were kicked out of the house. We'll talk about how this impacts, you know, social determinants of health in a bit. And for those who are in school and perceived as transgender, 17% left school as a result of severe mistreatment. So you can see how all of these different biases and minority stresses impact social determinants, which really impact people's life trajectory. And then the incredibly high level of sexual assault that was experienced at some point in their lifetime. So yeah, I mentioned here the social determinants. So when they surveyed folks, 29% of folks were living in poverty when they did the survey, 15% unemployment rate, only 16% home ownership, and 30% experiencing homelessness at some point in their lifetime, with 12% in the year prior to completing the survey. So, you know, as a Medicaid health plan, we're always aware of these social determinants and how they're impacting people's health outcomes, because how are you going to maintain your health when you're not sure where you're going to live, not sure if you're going to be employed, living in poverty and not having adequate social support. Suicide attempts, you know, again, these are numbers that you really do not see in a lot of other populations to such a high degree, where 40% had made at least one suicide attempt in their lifetime. So, I mean, this is definitely, when you think about the risks that are associated with not receiving gender-affirming care, it really is a sort of life or death situation. You can see a higher risk for suicide attempts based on physical or sexual violence experiencing either at school or at work. And these minority stressors can be additive in some ways, you know, if they've experienced harassment, family rejection, housing instability, discrimination in healthcare. What they found is that the more of those stressors were experienced contributed to an elevated prevalence of suicide attempts. And I think this last bullet point also highlights just that disclosure by itself is not necessarily a protective factor, that there is still a high risk of suicide attempts for those who had disclosed. So we did talk a little bit earlier about this healthcare provider stigma and how it impacts those who seek healthcare and whether they feel like they're being mistreated as a part of their healthcare experience. When you look specifically from health equity perspective, even deeper, looking at transgender people of color, there was a very high risk towards HIV in this population in particular. One of the highest risk groups of contracting HIV/AIDS are Black trans women. The rate of newly identified HIV infection was 2.6% for transgender people. And then the bigger challenge then here too is when, you know, linkage to care based on diagnosis. Most of the testing that's happening is often happening in non-clinical settings, which unfortunately led to a lower rate of linkage and retention to care. We know now that HIV is a can be managed as a chronic disease, just like many other chronic diseases, with the appropriate treatment and follow-up. But without that, you know, there is a risk for the opportunistic infections and developing AIDS. So we are seeing higher rates of that in this population, even though, and again, this it's all related to whether you can trust and work with your healthcare provider and whether there's a comprehensive program in place that's addressing the social needs and the comorbidities like substance use as well. So some of the issues that, like as a behavioral health professional that you may encounter when you're working with transgender folks are challenges around transitioning. So depending on where they are in their process, you may see folks at different parts of their process, whether it's coming to understand and accept gender dysphoria. For some folks, I remember seeing them and it was really the idea of even understanding gender dysphoria and coming to understand that this is an experience that they've been having since childhood, and trying to put a name on it was an important part of that process for them. And gender dysphoria, what it describes is the psychological distress that results from an incongruence between one's sex assigned at birth and one's gender identity. And so this is the clinical diagnosis that is given now, whereas before there was an older term of gender identity disorder that was we moved away from, because this more accurately describes the experience of the dysphoria. There may be another stage could be folks that are trying to understand how they come out and prepare others for changes in gender presentation. You know, is this something that I'm going to do with a select group of individuals to begin with? Or is this something that I may do more broadly? You know, how will I do this in the workplace, in school, with my family? So it's not like a one and done experience. It's usually a, you know, how I can prepare myself in different environments and different people in terms of my level of trust and safety. For some individuals, they may be interested in accessing hormone replacement, hormone treatment. And so depending on where they are, you know, is there a provider that can then help them do that? Is it done in a gender affirming way? And then looking at whether there's a need for insurance coverage, obviously, if that's an issue, if there's an interest in moving forward with a medical procedure like surgery, how they can get support around that, which usually involves getting letters from providers that allows the approval from the surgeon. There is oftentimes a need for changing identity documents, you know, so that they're not constantly being misgendered or not being their dead name is not being used as they are interacting with folks, you know, when they're using their identification. And again, I think I brought this up multiple times, the fear of interacting with healthcare providers and mental health professionals and how that can be facilitated as a part of your work with them. So kind of the standards that are really used and adopted worldwide are the WPATH standards of care. So if you ever want to go into a deeper dive and really understand the full range, this is kind of the best gold standard that we have now. And it is something that should be updated this year as well. So we're eager to see the updated version. And this is an important document from an insurance perspective too, because it does, it is the kind of standard that is used for clinical policy committee to determine medical necessity criteria for authorization requests for surgery and other treatments too. So in terms of what WPATH talks about for standards for mental health professionals is assessing for gender dysphoria, which again is the key clinical diagnosis that needs to be used for access to any sort of medicalized treatments, including hormones or surgeries. Assess, diagnose, and discuss treatment options for coexisting mental health concerns. Again, this doesn't mean the previous speaker talked about how historically mental health professionals were in a gatekeeper type of role, which is something that WPATH encourages mental health professionals to move away from. You are not, there is no requirement for meeting with a mental health professional as a part of your transition process. But, you know, as a part of your work with them, if there are comorbid mental health or substance use concerns, you know, discussing treatment options for them as a part of that. If applicable, assess eligibility, prepare and refer for hormone therapy. If applicable, assess eligibility and prepare, refer for surgeries. Typically, for breast or chest surgeries, there'd be one referral that may be needed from a qualified mental health professional. And typically for genital surgeries, there typically would be two referrals that would be needed from providers that had a relationship with them. And again, as I mentioned, you're not a gatekeeper. Psychotherapy is not an absolute requirement as it had been in the past. So typically, you know, the contents, if you were in a position where you were ever to write a letter for somebody who is trying to seek these types of procedures, the information in the letter would be general identifying characteristics, you know, a psychosocial assessment, diagnoses, the duration of your relationship with the client, including type of evaluation and any therapy of counseling to date. Again, this could just be a one-time evaluation that you provide. They don't have to be in active treatment with you. And so explanation that criteria for surgery have been met. Basically, by identifying that the individual has gender dysphoria and that they're, that is an indication that based on the way they are seeing and experiencing themselves and the distress that they're experiencing related to that discordance, that the surgery is a part of the goal of addressing the gender dysphoria. Obviously, with any surgeries, there's a statement about informed consent. And usually just some notification that you would still be available for coordination of care if needed. So I think it's important to recognize that this, again, if this is one of the primary ways that gender dysphoria can be addressed along with hormones and other non-medical treatments, you can see there are pretty significant outcomes associated with it. 42% reduction in psychological distress, 44% reduction in suicidal ideation, and even other health promoting behaviors like 35% reduction in tobacco smoking. And this was compared to a group of individuals who had not had gender affirming surgery, but had wanted it. So, and I also saw a recent study that just came out in April, I believe, in the Journal of Adolescent Health, which also looked specifically at gender affirming hormone therapy in a transgender or non-binary youth population. And that study also reported pretty significant reductions in depression, suicidality. So, you know, again, these gender-affirming care does lead to improved outcomes, especially as it relates to behavioral health issues. So other ways that, you know, as a healthcare provider, that you can just show that you are sensitive to these issues, that you provide gender-affirming care, that you are an ally, are displaying transgender LGBT-specific cues in your office, having gender-neutral restrooms, having a process in place on your intake forms where it's standardized, where patients have the option to indicate their current chosen name with another section left open for them to include the name that is indicated on legal documents. And then, so it automatically builds into your process. What is your legal name? What is your chosen name? What are you preferred to be? What is your preferred name? What are your preferred pronouns? Preferred pronouns is actually not the best term to say it, because it implies gender identity is preferential, but just allowing the patient to indicate what their pronouns are. Allowing on the intake form, allowing patients to state their gender identity. And if for some reason in the process you're unsure about a patient's gender identity or how they would like to be addressed, you know, it's okay to ask for clarification. You know, what pronouns do you use? Other things that can be built into your practice are establishing a policy for addressing discriminatory statements within your organization and staff. Because this is obviously something that has to be, just like in trauma-informed care, it has to be happening from the moment somebody walks in the door, your front desk person, the medical assistants, the providers, you know, to when they leave, or even what's on your website, and whoever is interacting with them should be held accountable for providing gender affirming care. And again, this was highlighted in the last talk, that keep the focus on care and the reason for the visit rather than indulging in questions of curiosity. So again, the misgendering can happen despite all of these processes you may put into place, and mistakes can happen, but there are ways to address and handle misgendering someone. So the best way to do, these are the ABCs of correcting mistakes: apologize and acknowledge, be attentive and responsive, no victim blaming, correct and adjust. I think, you know, those basics can help. Just even if mistakes are made, it shows that you are with your best intentions trying to work with the client and correcting for your mistakes and not being defensive about it. Again, this kind of is confirming some of the other things that were mentioned before. You know, don't ask questions that are not a necessity. It's not a training opportunity if it's not related to why they are there. You know, just like in HIPAA, you're not disclosing a person's transgender status to someone who does not explicitly need to know that. You know, the trauma-informed environment means that staff should not be able to gossip or joke about transgender people behind closed doors, that there should be policies in place to not allow for those types of behaviors. And again, knowing the proper terminology around gender-affirming surgery, gender-affirming hormone therapy, as opposed to some of the more outdated terms like sex change or gender reassignment. Again, these are ways that how we ask our question and the language we use matters. And so I think these are some good examples of, you know, as opposed to asking, does your family know? Do you have an emotional support system? Have you had the surgery? What does transition mean to you? So that means you sleep with, can you tell me about your relationships? You know, I'm not a specialist in this kind of thing. I'm still learning. Please hold me accountable as I learn. Are you sure you want this? You can't take it back. What questions do you have? You know, when did you decide to be trans? What has your transition been like so far? So you can see like that these have a very different tone to them, the way these questions are stated. So it's important to think about your language. And again, if you make a mistake, that's okay. Acknowledge say that you're trying to learn in this process and trying to do your best to provide the best care possible. So here's some other just sort of national resources and websites that are out there that you may want to look into as well if this is an area that you want to build more competency in. But really appreciate everybody signing on today, and happy to take questions with our other speaker today too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mogimi and Carmen. So please feel free to put questions in the chat, or you can also send those questions directly to Tony or myself. That is fine as well. So we do have some questions. We had one participant asking Dr. Mogimi that booklet you were speaking about earlier, is there a way to access that either a digital copy or a hard copy?
The WPATH Standards of Care, is that in reference to that one?
Yes.
Okay. I'll put a link in the chat.
Thank you very much. We did have a question. So the question is, the person is saying that they've heard people saying that you do not have to be, you don't need to know or understand everything about someone's identity to be affirming or respectful, and wondering if you could, either of you could speak to that a little bit more.
Could you repeat the question again?
Sure. I think that what the person is saying is that they've heard at another arenas or discussions that the message of you do not need to know every single thing or understand every single thing about someone's identity in order to be respectful or affirming, and was hoping that either of you could speak to that a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the points that was made in both my talk and Carmen's talk was that, you know, there may be many health-related visits that are not related to the person's gender identity or sexual orientation, and that, you know, you are there to help them address the problem that they are coming to see you for, right? And so I think in that arena, I mean, I think it's finding, you know, as a clinician, I think it's up to you to decide, like, well, is this an important part of what is the reason why they're here to see me now? Or if it isn't, is this more something that I'm doing for my own curiosity or for my own, oh, I've never worked with a transgender person before. I want to know more about their experience, but maybe that's not why they're there. You know, and so I think it's important as a clinician to try to focus on their needs and what is their priorities. And so, yeah, it may not be a factor in why they are there. I mean, obviously, if somebody is coming to you because they're trying to access hormone treatment or needing a letter for a surgery, I mean, it's obviously a very different, that's the primary reason why they're there. So you need to understand and assess for gender dysphoria and understand, you know, their experience as it relates to that. So I think it's, yeah, I don't know if there was, Carmen, you had anything else you wanted to add?
Just a lot of the things that Dr. Mogimi said about forms and paperwork, you know, asking pronouns, just, you know, having your practice and your space be affirming. And then also, as I mentioned earlier, not assuming things in itself is affirming. So, you know, of course you can ask someone what their pronouns is. No one's going to be offended if you ask them that. Going with that and not assuming anything else based on that.
Thank you. There is another question specifically addressing Dr. Mogimi. Can you explain a little more the recommendation not to ask for preferred pronouns, since that implies identity to be preferential? That is the first time I've heard it explained that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so that, you know, I think it's always a process of learning. I think that was something that, in my own experiences, that's an area that I recently came to better understand. I mean, I think just the term preferred implies, you know, that gender identity is preferential, you know, as opposed to that, you know, when you really talk to a lot of individuals who experience gender dysphoria from a young age, it really doesn't feel like something that's just preferential. I mean, it feels like something that is a part of how they're experiencing their identity, you know? So I think that for some individuals, I mean, this was in a recent talk that I saw given by folks around language, around this issue, that for some folks, just the term preferred pronouns is, you know, it can feel kind of offensive in some ways.
Great, thank you. And then another question was asking about what the importance is or why people are putting pronouns either after their name, or the person was commenting, they're noticing this a lot at work with signatures and people noting their pronouns, and just wondering the importance of that, or maybe why people are doing that.
I think it's important just because it shows everyone, you never know who you're talking to. It shows everyone that sharing your pronouns is normal and appropriate. And then it's okay to ask.
Yeah, I think it's just trying to, again, in the same way that we're talking about, you know, how do you standardize your questions around this on an intake form when you go to a health provider's office? You know, I think it's not making it something that, like, you are the exception to the rule, so that, you know, we are asking you because you are the exception. This is just, you know, we want to know from the onset, you know, what are your preferred pronouns and how you identify in your gender identity, to make it normalized and not have it be. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's the intention behind it, to try to make it feel more normalized and not something that's only specific for those folks, you know.
Great, thank you. Another question that was asked is, in what ways have you seen more or less acceptance of LGBTQ plus individuals in society?
That's a big question.
Yeah.
I'm not even really sure where to start with that. I think that in itself could be an entire presentation. You know, just even in recent years, we've had marriage equality pass, and now, as Dr. McGinney was talking about, some of the anti-trans laws that are coming up, it has kind of gone up and down.
Yeah, I think it's such a big topic. But yeah, I do think we're at such a juncture right now where it feels, you know, and again, so regionally kind of different in terms of being able to access care or getting, I was always very, when I was working at Whitman Walker, which, you know, is in Washington, D.C., is, I had several patients who basically moved to Washington, D.C. from pretty far areas, like from, you know, Central Florida or other places, just because they felt like that they had to make a move as dramatic as that to be able to access the care that they wanted to get. So that was always pretty striking to me, that because of this clinic, they moved to Washington, D.C. And I'm sure that's true for people at Mazzoni Center or other places in the country. Now there are telehealth companies that are also popping up that are trying to address this issue so that it's not specific to just where you're located and who the providers are nearest you. So I think that that's an interesting change, but I do think that says a lot to me that, you know, on the one hand, you have these centers of excellence that are really trying to provide high quality care, but that for some folks, you might have to travel hundreds of miles to get to them or even relocate.
Great, thank you. Thank you both for your comments. Another question, what are some things we can look for in providers to be sure we are referring our members to safe and affirming care, especially those who might not be near a provider like Alder Health?
Asking, you know, have you had training on LGBTQ plus issues or on transgender healthcare? Would be my first thought.
Yeah, I think you have to do your, I mean, part of the reason why I shared some of those local resources and national resources is a lot of people have done, you know, and particularly in the, if you look at message boards and people who are looking for these services, a lot of people sort of know where to go, who are the providers that are allies, who are not, you know, so I think it's important that, you know, you do your research and kind of know historically who has helped work with these populations or not. You know, for hormone replacement therapy for a long time, the pathway was through endocrinology offices, which, you know, endocrinologists are not, they may or may not be sort of practicing in a gender affirming way. It can, you know, they prescribe hormones broadly for many conditions. So I think that was a big issue for a long time, but you know, if it's an area that's focused on gender affirming hormone treatment, you know, you don't necessarily have to be an endocrinologist to do that. There, you know, where I work, there were places where physician assistants or primary care doctors, you know, built that sort of knowledge base to do that type of treatment. So I think it's about finding folks who have specialized in those types of services. And I think a lot of, you know, you reaching out to the resources and asking around, I think doing your due diligence around that will help to make the right referrals.
Thank you. And we have one last question. What can people do to be an ally?
All of the things that we have talked about so far, and also being not just feeling or thinking that you are, but being vocal about it and letting people know in some way, whether it's, you know, a sign on your door, a pin, you know, being outward about it.
Yeah, I think we're also in everything that Carmen said, and then I think we're also, people sometimes get very worried that they're just going to say or do the wrong thing. Maybe that can hold them back from, you know, the learning that it's okay if you make mistakes, that may be a part of the, your growth in terms of trying to be a good ally, you know, like that you are going to maybe say or do the wrong thing sometimes, but that's if you're willing to kind of hear what other people are how other people are reacting to it and being open to that and correcting yourself if needed, then, you know, I think that's an important part of this process too.
And just as I said, one last question, a few more came in. So I'm just going to read one, and then the one other question we can be easily addressed through email to the entire group. But was asked, do we see similar issues for BIPOC, LGBTQIA plus individuals with provider treatment? For example, sometimes family and or faith leaders do not accept their LGBTQIA plus children, church members. And it's noted that I know DC has a big homeless population among young BIPOC, LGBTQIA individuals.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the, you know, we both talked about minority stressors, and I do think there is sort of an additive effect of minority stressors too that you see. So unfortunately, I think the health equity issues are even more dramatic when you're talking about the BIPOC LGBTQIA population. And DC, I think that there is, as you mentioned, I mean, we actually have programs that are specifically available for the youth homeless population that identifies LGBTQ, because so many of them either don't feel comfortable in their house anymore or have been put out based on their sexual or gender identity. So, you know, I think it is an area where you really have to have the right resources and really trying to address the social determinants that come along with that. Luckily I think we do have good resources around trying to support this population, but I do think it, you know, it's one added layer of health inequity that is impacting their well-being.
So I see that we're 1 minute even past time. I want to thank both Carmen and Dr. Mogimi very much today for your presentations. And also thank you to everyone for your participation and questions and comments. There were many other comments that I just couldn't even get to, but mostly we're just saying, you know, agreeing with what you were saying and thanking you for the information. If anyone did submit a question and we just didn't get to it during the time, Tony and I can follow up to be sure that those questions get addressed and can send that out to the email group. For our last session in July, we'll be sending out an email with more information about that to all registrants. So thank you again, everyone, and I hope everyone has a great week. Take care.
Take care.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much.